great. Just sitting down with Ronnie this afternoon. Thanks so much for being here and agreeing to share your story with us. We're looking forward to hearing about your experiences. So just to get started, when did you get involved in the gay community or start engaging in gay life?
Probably when I was about 17, when I moved here to Canada from the United States. So when I moved here from California.
So you moved to Vancouver from California?
Yeah, I came to live with my mom and was living with my mom. She was a mom, single mom, three kids, my stepbrother and sister. So I came to live with her because, dad was, my dad wasn't really in the picture and was busy and didn't have a really good parent active lifestyle. So I wanted to come and be around somebody who was going to be a parent, who was going to be there. So I decided to come here and move with my mom and live in Canada.
And what did the gay community look like in Vancouver at the time?
Well, pretty much if any of you have ever seen Hookers on Davey, which is a very big cult film back in the day that was filmed here in Vancouver, that was pretty much what lifestyle was like. Hamburger Mary's was run by actual Hamburger Mary, who was like a 300-pound transvestite. She was actually Canada's first, or Vancouver's first transgender back in the day. And she ran Hamburger Mary's back then. Davie Street was definitely different. The night scene or nightclub scene definitely was different. We had about 15 different gay bars in Vancouver to opposed to like six now on the strip. Definitely more human interaction, more cruising. There was definitely more cruising going on, like beaches, bathrooms, a lot more of that going on where people were actually communicating, flirting, interacting. Now it's all social media now. Nobody talks to anybody except through a device. So definitely different than that. And a lot more engaged back then.
And did you get involved in like the bar scene or the club scene?
I was the bar scene, pretty much. Like pretty much my first job, official job, was working at a place called Benjamin's, which used to be back in the day on Denman Street. And it was a small little cafe where a lot of gay men would come after the bars, because like I said, we had a lot of bars back then. So people would go there, and I had sort of like a little waitering job. I was helping serve tables, and then they kind of hired me as a dishwasher. And so, yeah, I was definitely always flirty, playful type of person. So I wanted to be somewhere where, of course, the center of attention, because that's who I am. That's who I've always been. And so every part of the gay community that I was involved with, like pride parades, drag performances, balls, cotillions, all that stuff that went in the gay community, I was pretty much right in the middle of it all the time. So definitely very active in the social part of it, the party part of it, and the recreational part of it.
Was the drag scene a lot different than it is now?
Yes, they were all a lot younger. I didn't have to wear as much Spanx. It was a little bit more involved, meaning the shows were much better, put together a lot better than they are now, and the performers were definitely more talented than what we're seeing now. They did actual, I remember back in the day when the Odyssey was still on Howe Street, a drag queen by the name of Justine Time, he was a bartender there named Todd, And he's an amazing performer, so if anyone's ever seen him, you would know what I'm talking about. And they did the whole entire musical of Sound of Music and broke it down, the whole story, broke it down to like an hour and a half performance. And it was pretty well put together and definitely choreographed, but had the spontaneity of ad-libbing too, like in the moment, which made it really funny. And then they did Grease after that. So you don't see that anymore in the drag scene now. It's just sort of quick, thrown together, weird stuff that's just not like what it used to be back in the day.
And when did you first hear about HIV or AIDS?
Well, actually through cinema. I mean, I knew in the 80s it was a big thing. I didn't know really about it, what it meant to a gay man until I moved to BC. Because in California, I grew up with money. My dad was pretty well off, so I hung around and ran around with rich kids and wasn't really involved with my gay lifestyle yet. So, and both my dad and grandfather were both rednecks, hardcore. So just the thought that his son might have been homosexual was like a big reason. And part of the reason why I think I moved here too, because I don't think I could have been myself. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was the first to actually approach him and say that I wasn't going to be like other boys, that I was going to be different because I want to learn how to cook and clean and sew and do these wifely duties or these feminine qualities. And my dad was like, oh, great. So obviously the idea of homosexuals, my dad actually used the word faggot several times, queers, weirdos, definitely saw it as an illness. It is a mental illness. Also used other explanatory words of other races and cultures. So pretty much hardcore redneck. So I didn't really learn about HIV or even AIDS until I'd come here and gotten a little bit involved with the gay community and was over at a friend's place. And he said, well, you gotta see this movie. And it was called Long Time Companion. And it was the first movie that I had ever seen about HIV illness or AIDS. And it was pretty intense. Obviously, to follow other movies, Philadelphia, Life of the Party. Other movies came out after that. So it was mostly through, I guess you could say, television and through media that I was mostly learning about HIV and AIDS.
And as you were encountering that early information or that early kind of media around HIV, do you recall how you were kind of responding to that information?
It was pretty scary because back then it was, when you were diagnosed, it was pretty much a death sentence because they didn't really even have medications right off the bat that were life-sustaining like they do now. So most people who got it were gone within a year, less than that sometimes. I definitely met a lot of people back in the day, most of them through prostitution. I prostituted. Also, when I first moved here, a friend of mine who also was a male escort approached me and said it was a good way to make money and. Yeah, so then they thought that I would be good at it. So that sort of concerned me too, was my, would I be the one to get it, I guess, because of my sexual escapades, so to speak. Part of me still thinks that it could have been from prostitution, but 90% of me pretty much thinks that I got this illness from my sexual escapades and maybe the places I worked. I also worked in a bathhouse couple of bathhouses for quite a few years, so that definitely led to a lot more sex than usual.
Was the, I mean, I'm not entirely familiar with the kind of male sex work scene in Vancouver in the early 80s. Was that like a, was there a pretty tight-knit community in that that kind of realm as well?
Yeah, we definitely looked after each other. Like I said, the hookers on Davey movie touched more about what we go through emotionally. You pretty much have to shut your emotions off. There was quite a few times in my life where I've had to shut my emotions off to do my job, and definitely being a prostitute was one of them. Working for a funeral home was another one, where you just have to shut off your emotions. Unfortunately, what happens is when you get to be a little older, you become what's called jaded, and you don't have these emotions, so you become kind of cold and cold-hearted to a lot of things. So that definitely is something that could be sort of a an aftermath, but we definitely watched out over each other. We had not Johns or pimps, but we had people who would take down our information, take down license plate numbers when we would be with a client, watch the time. If we weren't back in that said time, then the proper authorities were notified, either missing or never came back. Or so it was very important that we let the person know who was kind of watching over us, that we were back, that we were okay, and everything was fine, because there were definitely some clients and situations where it could have gotten dangerous. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely in the movie, you see one of the transgenders, her name is Michelle. She was known as Marc Michelle. She came from Montreal. Kind of knew her with quite a few of the other sex trade workers. Unfortunately, she was murdered, so it can end badly. It can definitely end badly, and you are taking your life in your own hands. You're in places, you're not always in, you're not always in safe situations like in buildings or facilities. A lot of times you're in the middle of nowhere in a car. So somebody wants to have their way and dump your body somewhere, it can be done. And then you're just found like everyone else. So it's definitely a risk that you take when you do that kind of profession. Wow.
Did that community change a lot over the course of the 80s?
It did. The city moved the prostitutes around quite a bit. So back in the day, like in the 80s when it first started, the transgenders hung out up by Hamburger Mary's off of Butte, in the back alley of Butte, and off of Davie. The boys, the male prostitutes were on Broughton and Pendrell, actually right by the church there. We used to sort of hang out there right by that Catholic church or Protestant church. I'm not sure what kind of religion it is, but it was a big church. So we kind of hung out on the corners there. I'm sure the Lord wasn't too impressed about that. However, we hung out there. That was our working spot. And then the girls were way down on Georgia, downtown, like Georgia and Granville area. That's where the girls kind of were. And then through the years, they kind of shoved us down further and further. And so we kind of went, the transgenders ended up on Seymour and Davy. And then the boys, what was left of them, were working down on like Hornby and Drake area, like down there, down by the casino. So definitely changed, the quality of service that you would get at a male escort today, not so much. You're gonna get something that's damaged quite a bit with drugs, addiction issues, hygiene issues, STDs. So you're definitely going to probably, if you still see male hookers out there, they're probably going to be, I wouldn't do it. Don't do it. It's not as thought out and clean as it used to be.
So as the epidemic kind of continued, were there any other sources of information that you encountered? Was it being talked about a lot within the community, for instance?
It was mentioned. It was always referred to as the big one, you know, because it was killing people. So it was the ultimate STD. Myself, out of all the years that I've been sexually active, I have been tested for all the STDs, but HIV was the only one that stuck. And I think had crabs once after HIV, and a lovely little boy from Chicago gave a roommate and I scabies. That was awesome. That's another one. That's pretty nasty. But there again, nothing compares to the long-term process that you go through with HIV and AIDS. I'd say, though, unfortunately today, most of the young community, like 20 plus, don't really have a set foot on the difference between AIDS, HIV, because they really seem to be really freaked out and really uneducated about the do's and don'ts and dangers of HIV.
Why do you think that is?
Maybe because they're more focused on living they're enjoying their lifestyle the way it is, like the clubs, the drugs, the recreational drug use, the partying. Maybe they don't want to put stock in it, I don't know, or they just don't want to take the time. But I've noticed that being a gay male with HIV, I always have to definitely let a partner know, potential partner though, that I'm HIV, and let him know in my status in any situation, whether it be casual, one night stand, anything. And I find a lot of the younger guys freak out and decline and say no, whereas of course the older ones, closer to my age and up, and that's like the early 40s to late 50s, know the ins and outs and know the dangers, and it's not really a big deal to them.
Hmm. So part of that might be like stigma around HIV? For younger guys, maybe?
Yeah, and they, I think, see it as a serious, maybe death sentence even still, even though now it's more become a chronic, life-sustaining still, but chronic illness.
So when did HIV start to be something that was kind of visible in the community from your perspective? Like when do you remember seeing it?
Well, definitely it would have to go back to just after Expo, because that's pretty much what brought me here to live here, was Expo 86. I worked at the California Pavilion, being from California. Really wish I would have really kept my Teddy Ruxpin, because now they want $300 for him on eBay now. Really wish I would have kept that bear. But yeah, it definitely started to show up because the group of friends that I was hanging out with were starting to get sick around me. And Jeff was a good friend of mine. He was somebody who I remember being the first to get the illness, and we all just thought it was a cold, a flu. At the time, we didn't really tie it to anything significant, even what was going on in the news. Like, there was no talk of patient zero, as they refer to it as now. Back in the day, a lot of people still think it's government made, or something made to wipe out a genocide issue or an illness. Some people think it's spread from the monkeys. Everybody's got their different theory. But we didn't know what it was, and we all thought Jeff was just like sick with a cold or a flu. It got worse. His health was declining. He definitely was your first basic visible side effects were happening. He was getting those lesions on his face. Definitely thin and skinny. Almost like a cancer, like how people go through cancer. So it was later on referred to as gay cancer, because that's kind of what it does. It drains your energy. When you're sick, your good days, you're feeling great, top of the world. Your bad days, you are sick, you're weak, you can't do much, don't want to eat. Your body kind of goes through a shutdown. So, yeah, and he was a young guy. He was only 23 or 24 when he died. And he unfortunately committed suicide, took his own life. A lot of people back then who were diagnosed did commit suicide. They figured it was easier, maybe less painful. Maybe they figured that they were doing their family and friends a favor, because it was definitely, I know when I've been at my most sickest, I feel like a burden to my family and my friends too, quite a bit, because everyone wants to get involved and everyone wants to try to make you feel better and do things for you, but you kind of just have to get yourself up and running, because with HIV and AIDS, you can end up with, especially just with HIV, you can end up with your own illnesses that have nothing to do with common colds or flus. You just have your own sicknesses that will come on and zap your energy and just take you out. So that was definitely the start. Jeff was definitely the start, first one to go, where we saw the impact that the illness has on the body and the toll that it takes. After that, it was just friend after friend that was going down for the count. So pretty much we're in 2018, so 23, 24 years I've had this now. And I've lost at least, I don't know, at least good three decades. Sorry, that's 10 years. So at least two solid decades of friends to this illness. Even with medications now, I mean, it still ticks you down. You never know what it's going to be. Hepatitis C seems to be a really big one right now. And prostate cancer. So those seem to be cancers in general. Another friend of mine, there are a couple, and he's just gone through testicular cancer surgery and lost one testicle, and I think they're gonna take the other one now, but it seems to be keeping the cancer in remission. So definitely cancer is a common factor that takes a lot of HIV and AIDS patients down fast.
So even with like new medications, there's still concerns.
Yeah, even with. Even myself, I'm on life-saving medications now, which seem to be good, but in the last 10 years, I've been on 7 different medications because they work for a while. You have to be really good about taking your medications. I'm not the best patient for that. I forget doses quite a bit or miss doses. I'm trying to be better now. Unfortunately, my last doctor's visit was not a good one. The virus has gotten a little bit more aggressive. At this point, I am more detectable now. So I'm a high risk right now. And it's definitely wreaked some serious havoc in my lifestyle and in my life in general, with illnesses, being tired and fatigued a lot, and altering quite a bit of my life right now.
Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that with us, because I think we have this, there's kind of a broad conception that, you know, the real serious health effects are diminishing right now because of the medications, but there's still these, you know, underlying issues that are pervasive still, I think, as you're kind of saying, which is important for us to capture, I think, absolutely. So how was the community responding at the time? You know, thinking back to those earlier years again.
Some got really emotional and got involved in it. Definitely got involved in protesting. Protesting was a big thing. Unfortunately, when we tend to get protesting going, it's always extreme protesting. We always seem to get the extremists in the gay community that want to protest, and it's not always thought out. So for instance, when HIV and AIDS was open and being talked a lot about in the news, and deaths were being announced left, right, and center, vigils were being done left, right, and center. Maybe even the first one, we started doing the first Walk for Life. Back in the day, a lot of the community were very close-knit, but society, of course, their fear of the unknown and their judgment issues fired a lot of the protests. So the gay community started protesting, and they were doing, back in the day, they were doing things like laying in middle of traffic at like rush hour and drawing chalk lines around each other and leaving chalk line bodies of people who had passed away all over the city, kind of shoving it and rubbing it in society's face, which wasn't really a smart idea because that really caused a lot of conflict. And then there was an uprising of bashings and attacks in the West End. So, yeah, it kind of... stirred up a lot of emotions, definitely. As far as the community goes, we still stay pretty close, tight-knit. Some were cold, some were turned off, saying, well, that's what they get. I mean, I had a few friends, too, that treated me that way back in the day when I told them. They were like, well, that's kind of what you get. Are you really surprised? You were kind of a whore. So what do you expect? So you're going to get those mixed... emotions of, you deserve it, those people deserve it, it's God's punishment, you're going to get them all. But I can speak on behalf of my mom, who's a born-again Christian. No, she does not see it as God's punishment. It is a sin, and we all have to pay for our sin, but she does not believe that it is a punishment from God. So that fallacy is, I just want to make that one clear, that it's not a punishment from God. But that's definitely, yeah, the community was sort of mixed on those who had friends, I think, and were involved in the situation were maybe a little bit more emotional involved. Those who didn't understand or it frightened them were definitely cold and unemotional about it.
So your sense is that, just to go back to something you said earlier, that like activism, for instance, maybe exacerbated things instead of improving them.
Yeah, just the way it was done. It was like, you know, we have the right to do this, and we have the right to do that, and fight, fight, fight. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, so intense. So rather than just do what you want, who cares if they don't like it? Just everything had to be, you know... And it was almost like it was going towards the direction of victimizing, you know, we're victims. This illness is, you know, victimizing, and illnesses don't do that. So, yeah, I just think it had more of a negative effect on it than it could have in the beginning.
And were you aware of what AIDS service organizations were doing at the time?
Didn't know about anything like that until later, until like the late 90s, like when we had friends, you know, Friends for Life or AIDS Vancouver, you know, like any of those places didn't come around until much later. I'd already been, you know, on medications and had this illness for quite some time before any sort of places opened that were embracing the gay community that were HIV positive, and programs and things like that. Now you have camping they do, they've got the Friends for AIDS for Vancouver has all kinds of services now, counseling, different kinds of support groups, food bank, cosmetic services. You can get your hair cut for people who are on a disability or a fixed income. So there's tons of outreach programs now. So yeah, definitely a lot more than what we had back in the day. Was just sort of through media, maybe Little Sisters bookstore back in the day had speakers quite a bit that would come in and speak. Also in the early 90s, late 80s, in one of the bathhouses that I worked at, we actually had nurses that came one night a month and gave a talk on safe sex, condom uses, needle use, some addiction issues, and spoke about HIV and AIDS and prevention. So we actually, back in the day, had people who were doing that in communities, maybe in the bars too, I don't remember. But we've definitely had some representation in nightclubs too with speakers just promoting safe sex or safer sex issues for people who are HIV. You also saw it being mentioned in the public media, like on TV shows. I have just now recently started watching Designing Women again. For any of you who don't know about that, that was a show in the 1980s about four Southern women who owned a design group. And they even, one of their episodes was about a dear friend of theirs who ended up getting AIDS back in the day, and he'd come in and ask them to design his funeral and do the decorations for his funeral because he had just found out that he was diagnosed with AIDS and was going to die. And again, it happened really fast because that's what happened. Back in the day, they only had a few medication options, which were really rough, a lot of side effects. And they addressed that, and it was a very emotional episode. And there was, so if any of you are interested in checking it out, the name of the actual episode is, the name of the show is Designing Women, and the actual name of the episode was Killing All the Right People, because it had to do with one woman in the show who was religious, born again. And she saw it as God's punishment, and she said, if you're asking me, it's killing all the right people. And so that's unfortunately the way a lot of the community still sees the gay community, and especially the ones who have AIDS and HIV. They figure it's that's what we get, that's what we, for being a deviant, that's the punishment we deserve, and that's the that's what we deserve. That's what we should get for being who we are. So yeah, you should definitely check out that episode. It will let you know on how, what kind of attitude should have been, that we should have today about it, actually.
Was that view, like that mainstream kind of view, that kind of blamed gay men. Was that pretty pervasive at the time in the 80s?
It was. It was all our fault, you know. It was only gay people who had HIV and who were being infected, you know. Wasn't even really talking about through how you got infected, through what kind of way you were infected, you know. Like now it's a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of people with needles, drug issues are catching HIV. That was the second most popular way, or more presentable way people were getting it in the early 90s, was through through needle use, dirty needles. Then they started to see it more and more in the heterosexual community, and women were getting it. Not even necessarily lesbian or gay women, but straight women were getting it. Kind of took the spotlight off the gay community, being only the gays. I really think it's because people maybe just saw it as a gay illness, is because us being gay men and being men in general, where we're very sexually active. When we get aroused or turned on, we definitely have to do something about it, either have sex or take care of it ourselves. It's not a feeling that kind of goes away. Whereas women can definitely pass those modes. So I think that they think that gay men, you know, when they're sexually active, they just have to be just passing it all around all the time, just constantly having sex. And there's also a misconception too of in the gay community of two gay men being able to be just friends and not having sex with each other. Like, that is a misconception I had to clear up with my own mother. A lot of misconceptions growing up, having to tell her what gay lifestyle is really like. No, we don't all want to dress in women's clothing. No, we don't all act effeminate. No, we don't all sleep together, friends or no friends. Two guys can be friends and not sleep together. So there's a lot of misconception of the gay community out there too. A lot of the people still see us as sexual deviants, pedophiles, thinks that we like all boys, all ages, and that we're like sexual deviants. So when they see AIDS and HIV, they see that as a punishment for being a sexual deviant, mm-hmm. and that still is being seen today.
Just to circle back to your time working in the bathhouse, that's really interesting to me. So what was, do you remember what was being said at those like workshops and around safe sex?
They just wanted you to know that there were options to protect yourself from sexual STDs and obviously HIV. They wanted to inform you of possible ways of infection, low risk, high risk. You know, if you were willing to go in and sit down, and they had taken a room in one of the bathhouses, so you would go in and sit down with them and shut the door and have a one-on-one conversation with someone. But I guess they just felt it was a good place to do that because people were there engaged with sex, so maybe they felt it was important so they could maybe prevent any bad choices being made, or let people know that if they proceed in the way of sexual intercourse under influence of recreational drug use or the effects of recreational drug use and alcohol, which is definitely a big thing in bathhouses, the dangers that can ensue and the consequences that would be forthcoming.
Do you remember if you was there like posters or other literature available at the bathhouse on the days when there weren't there wasn't a nurse there?
They would definitely have posters up. It was mostly advertising for places where there were going to be speakers. Like Joe Average was somebody back in the day who was very well known. I don't know if he actually himself was HIV positive or, but he was definitely tied to, being involved in the community with HIV. So there's definitely those posters up, usually him sponsoring it or something like that, where you could go to listen to speakers, where you could go if you think that you might be positive. They also handed out lots of brochures, definitely lots of condoms, and made sure that the bathhouse always had lots of condoms on supply. So they definitely were interactive and cared about the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting because, of course, in some cities, they closed the bathhouses completely, right? In San Francisco, for instance, and in Vancouver, that didn't happen. And it was obviously a good place for education, maybe to, as you're kind of indicating, maybe a good place for education to happen. So just an interesting sidebar for me. Do you recall at all what the early medical response looked like?
Oh, for someone that was, what do you mean? Medical response meaning?
To HIV.
Do you mean medications or do you mean?
More like healthcare providers.
Healthcare providers. We definitely had lots of free clinics back then. I'm not sure when the IDC clinic came about, but definitely more GPs, just regular general practitioners, were starting to go to conferences. That's when they started offering a lot of conferences for GPs, because it wasn't just specialists. We didn't really have HIV specialists like we do nowadays who specialize in specific HIV or AIDS-related illnesses or issues. We definitely have more than we did then. But back then, yeah, a lot of GPs were going to conferences, traveling, going to hear about new medications, treatments, symptoms. Although most of the symptoms were pretty basic, they have learned that there is more to the virus, what it does to the body, and they're getting more in depth of a breakdown of what you could possibly get or what you couldn't. But the strain with the illness is so different and so unique for everybody. Everybody is different on their levels of their illness and their levels and their design. This disease is really really odd and very intelligent in a lot of ways. For instance, if you miss medications a lot, this is why your nurses, your doctors, your professionals that you see now, your medical people, they tell you that taking your medications regularly is very important, because missing what they call a drug holiday, missing doses, the illness can actually figure out when it's being attacked, what it's being attacked by, and actually change in a way that it can defend itself against your medications until the point where the medication is just no longer good and useful, and the virus has become more aggressive and just takes out the medication. So the way it can alter always gives them a challenge of how to fight it, how to beat it.
And were you aware of when HIV testing became available? Was that like a notable development or not something you really noticed?
That wasn't something I noticed or even went for, unfortunately, until I was diagnosed. I was working at a bathhouse in New West at the time and was feeling sick, and it started as a flu. and a cold, and I was sick for like a really long time. Like this flu just was not letting go of me. And then my ankle swelled up and my knee swelled up, and I had like a hot fluid in there. So I thought it was, I'm not sure what it was. One of my friends said it could have been an STD. So I remember going to the clinic then and being tested. And they said, have you ever been tested for HIV? And I said, AIDS. You mean AIDS? And they said, well, no, HIV. AIDS is something that is referred to as AIDS-related diseases. So you become full-blown only by the illnesses and the ravageness of the virus in your body. So when you first get sick, you're HIV. So I said, I've never heard of such a thing. And that's when it took 10 days to get the results. And they had to do several different tests, like a Western blot test and another kind of test and this other test. And unfortunately, a lot of times what was happening is people were getting misdiagnosed. And then they were being told that they had HIV. That had quite a bit of impact, misdiagnosis. Some people lost their jobs. Some people couldn't get jobs. If it had to be, back in the day, you kind of had to tell all on a job application or let your employer know your medical history. So if they found out that you were diagnosed with HIV, yeah, and you wouldn't be hired, you wouldn't be taken on. So there were definitely some prejudice against that back in the day. So no, I'd never heard of such a thing. Testing. I just figured if you got it, you got it. I didn't know that there was like all this testing and stuff. So of course, I was like, okay, I guess, what do you do? And they just draw blood. So I was like, well, I've had this done before. But yeah, it's definitely different than getting your blood drawn or donating blood. Different emotional attachment there, especially when you get your results.
And how did you deal with that?
Pretty cold. It had been 10 days. They called me back to go back to find out what the problem was. And then I hadn't tested positive for chlamydia or gonorrhea or any of that, which was a good thing. But then the worker, I was with some family members at the time too. I was with my sister and we had some friends from out of family. I had to come forward to my family that I had an HIV test and explain to them what that was. Was pretty much the hardest thing I ever had to do with my mom, because my mom had been through a lot already with me moving here and her hands full with my brother and sister trying to raise them, and having to deal with having a gay son, and then having to deal with a gay son who was prostituting, and now telling my mom that I may or may not have an illness that will kill me, that is terminal, that there is no cure for. So pretty much really hard to tell her. So I was on pins and needles, got there, a woman sat me down and my life was on a computer screen, and she said, I'm going to turn the screen around and it's either reactive or non-reactive. Reactive meaning you have the virus, non-reactive meaning you're okay. So when she turned the screen around, I saw that it was reactive, took a deep breath, was quiet for a bit. She asked me if I was okay, and I said, actually, I'm surprised it hasn't happened sooner. And she's like, what? And I was like, well, you know, I'm a bit of a whore. So I said, yeah, I'm definitely very active. And then she proceeded to give me a piece of paper where she wanted me to write down within the last 6 months of the partners that I had been with. And I said, well, 6 months, 3 months, or 1 month? And she goes, well, 6 months is good. And I said, well, I'm going to need a lot more paper. And she was like, what? And so I had to sort of let her know that there was all these outlets and places to go for gay men to have sex. You know, there was bathhouses, there was beaches, there was parks, there was restrooms, there was nightclubs. She was like, whoa. She had no idea. She had no idea there was all this going on. So she's like, wow, no wonder, like, HIV and AIDS is going to be, is such a thing, and why so many people were being infected left, right, and center, and it was just spreading like crazy, like wildfire. It was shocking, but I kind of made peace with myself immediately, saying, well, think of your lifestyle, think of your recreational drug use and your irresponsibility of not using condoms, not using sexual aids to prevent STDs, you know? And then definitely guilt. Definitely feeling totally guilty. And then feeling like I needed to just let everybody and anybody I'd ever slept with to go get tested immediately. That was definitely my first response. Because at that point, we had figured out that I had had it for almost a year. I didn't even realize it.
And that must have been very hard too, having to reach out to partners and stuff.
It kind of makes you feel, yeah, a little rejected, because people see you differently, definitely. You definitely change. What you do is you educate yourself, first of all, on safe sex and what safe sex really means and what options you have out there. And you definitely have to relearn your lifestyle or change things in your lifestyle. And you have to not be so hard on yourself and convince yourself that you're doing the right thing if you get turned down. You're doing the right thing by telling and acknowledging somebody that you are a risk.
Did you have a lot of support around you as you were dealing with that diagnosis?
My brother and sister were still teenagers. So they pretty much were freaked out, and I kept most of my life and illnesses that I had quiet from them. But my mom pretty much has been always there, unconditional, and she likes to like get on the soapbox every once in a while and preach it out and try to get me to maybe change, but I'm me, and I'm gonna be me the way I am. But she's always been there, and then definitely I've had a lot of friends support. So there's definitely been some good support out there.
And it's interesting to hear that your mom was has been very supportive. I think a lot of the time we hear stories of like rejection by family and stuff like that. So
yeah, one of the friends that we buried back in the day, his family weren't even aware that he was gay. I think they suspected it, but when it came out that he was gay and then he had passed away from this illness, there was not one family member that showed up to his funeral. Not one. Not a brother, not a sister. He had quite a big family too. Not one brother, not one sister, his parents, no grandparents, no aunts and uncles, like no one. It was all gay community, his partner at the time, and his partner's family, and his friends' families, and his friends, but nobody showed up from his family. So, and a lot of cultures too, even today. Indian culture, Muslim culture, Chinese culture, it's still seen as a disgrace. Homosexuality is still seen as a disgrace in the family. So a lot of these guys who end up dying or passing away, although you don't really hear that much now, thank goodness, people passing away from AIDS or HIV. It's not plastered on two or three people every day in the obituaries like back in the day. Medications are better. People are living longer. They're catching it faster. It's definitely evolved from what it was before, but there are still there's still issues with that.
Thinking back to the earlier period again, do you recall what government responses looked like at the time?
So one of the very first organizations that started for HIV for me, and I like to think that I am still the pioneer that started it, but it's Heart of AIDS in Richmond is an organization. And I was on the bus coming back from a doctor's appointment, and at this point, this was still early when I had been diagnosed with HIV. So maybe 98 or 99 back then. And I was on crutches, and I was speaking to this woman about what I'd been through, and it just felt open for some reason to talk to this woman. And she went back and talked to her husband about it because they had a gay son who also was in this predicament of this illness, a lot more advanced than I was. And so they wanted to pick my brain about how I felt about it in my ups and downs and what medications I was taking and what treatments. And back in the day, I was taking quite a few pills. Today, I only take 2 pills once a day. And it's pretty easy, very minimal side effects for this particular medication. But back in the day, I was on 4 different pills, 3 times a day. So it was a lot. The side effects were really nasty. So they talked to me, and I told them my ins and outs. And of course, couldn't work anymore. Was too sick to hold down a full-time job, so I had to go on EI. And take a medical disability or medical leave then when I wasn't going to return back. And the ministry came in. And I definitely had to fight a lot. There's a lot of government fighting I had to do. I had to go to arbitration and have government people fight for me, or advocates. And actually at the time, AIDS... Vancouver was there to be an advocate and fight for me. But going back to the couple that I was talking about, Heart of AIDS, they ended up starting an organization because they lost their son to HIV and AIDS. And there was so much red tape with the government. When he died, they didn't receive any of the money for his life insurance or money to pay for medical expenses or the funeral. until about 6 months after he had passed away, because the government just tied it all up with red tape and didn't even, because everything was in his name, and they didn't even believe that there, you know, they had to prove everything. And they had to prove, you know, and the insurance, life insurance, they had to fight because he was HIV, and they claimed that they didn't let him know that he had an illness that was terminal, and they felt defrauded. So it was a big mess. It was a big battle. I am on I'm on a disability through the government, half provincial and half federal. If and when I pass away, CPP will, I think, offer $2,500 to my mom or whoever's in charge of my estate. So I think the ministry gives you some money too for when you die towards your burial, but that's all. I mean, pension checks will stop, of course, but definitely it can be quite a mess. The government makes cuts all the time, though. They're always cutting funding for this or that, or I even had to fight for extra little bits through the IDC, like for nutrition, and I don't know, like you definitely have to fight for the government for coverage, for things that you need, medications. Some are covered, some aren't. PharmaCare, there's a lot that's not covered for medications that you take to deal with other illnesses that come up. So they can be quite a handful to deal with.
And still, in the present as well.
A little bit better, but yeah, still a handful.
Thinking on a larger scale, how do you think the epidemic changed the gay community, if it did in any way?
Well, this always comes up in one of the surveys that I do for Momentum Health study here. The question always comes up saying, if, you know, if they came out with a cure tomorrow, do you think it would change people's views on safer sex, or do you think people would straighten up and fly right? I think people are going to do what they're going to do. Some feel that they're superheroes and that nothing's ever going to get them sick, or they don't ever get sick and nothing's ever going to get them and they can do whatever they want. Some have definitely gotten smarter and wiser. You don't really hear any talk about safe sex or promotion about safe sex anymore. Like, all the gay prides that we've had and recent drag shows that I've seen, productions, they used to close the show, like back in the 90s, a lot of drag queens would close the show saying, get home safe, use a condom, have safe sex. They used to promote that. You don't hear that anymore. So it's almost like the community is like, yeah, we know it's there, but it's not our problem. So we're just not going to think about it.
Seems to have fallen off the radar a little bit.
Sort of. It's kind of like, we know it's there, but eh. You know, and there's medications that are great now, so people are living longer, so you know, so we're just going to keep doing what we're going to keep doing.
Yeah, was the drag community involved in the response to the epidemic in any ways that you saw?
There were definitely some fundraisers and money being raised going to AIDS Vancouver, to Friends for Life. Yeah, so I mean, you know, when there was fundraisers or functions going on, We have the Walk for Life every year. They definitely, which I believe is coming up this month, or I think it comes in September usually. You'll see posters go up and stuff like that, but again, in the shows, there's not really a big talk about it and promoting it, like you need to do it or you should sign up and sponsor someone or something like that. So again, they just figure everybody knows it, so why over-accentuate it?
But as you said, it seems like that message is not getting to everyone.
No. Because, I mean, yeah, like I said, the younger community, there's a lot of them that don't know the ins and outs, the do's and don'ts, and what resources are available for even just educating them.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of those younger folks in the community, do you have any advice for them based on your experiences?
Definitely use a condom. Assume everybody's HIV positive. I know it sounds like a bad thing to do, like assume every black person is a thug and assume every Muslim person's a terrorist, but no, that's not the direction I'm going. Just assume everybody is HIV positive. Use condoms. Make good choices, you know, like no, it's not always good to engage in sexual activities when you're on recreational drugs. If you need to, if you enjoy using recreational drugs and need to use recreational drugs, then just dance and party and have a good time, but don't engage in sexual escapades because it can end badly. HIV is still out there. It is a chronic illness, but it's still out there, and there are some flies in the ointment of having this illness. So just make good choices and educate yourself and know what's out there. I understand there is a program called PrEP or a medication called PrEP now out there. So I think that's for people who can kind of protect themselves or give themselves a pre-strike against getting HIV. So definitely, you know, educate yourself to what's new, what's out there, what's happening.
And what about for folks who might be newly diagnosed? Any advice for them?
It's not a death sentence. Don't be so dramatic. If you get diagnosed, there's medications that are good out there. You do have to make some life changes. You definitely have to take better care of yourself. Just take it easy on your body. Because the more you wear out the body, the more your immune system gets lowered, and your immune system is, HIV is all about your immune system because you don't have any. So you have to really, not party harder, make some life changes, definitely use those condoms, educate yourselves on the do's and don'ts. You can still have a very active sex life. You just have to be a little bit more careful on your sexual practices.
Great. And any advice for health professionals based on your experiences? Are there things that we maybe need to be doing better in terms of healthcare?
I think we're pretty good now. Back in the day when I was going for my second HIV test just to confirm that I actually had the illness, because like I said, there was a lot of misdiagnoses out there. So what they do is they'll, when you go see your actual doctor, they'll do another retest. And I had a blood lab person that was withdrawing blood, and I said, so this is for the second HIV test, and she said, HIV, and she freaked out, she looked at me, and she pulled away, and acted totally freaked out, and you could definitely tell that she was freaked out about, did I get any blood on my gloves? Did I poke myself? She was totally freaked out. Made me feel really uncomfortable. So I'm hoping that professionals out there are more educated and know that, that there's a lot of that it's not as dangerous as they, I don't know, dealing with it and working with it. Just be professional and compassionate, definitely, and listen to what your patients are saying, and listen to what your people are telling you and how they feel emotionally, what their emotional state is, because a lot of medical professionals are very busy and they just want to get you in and out and give you your medicine and your pills and whatever, but they're not really listening to what possibly could be going on at the time.
So I think I've covered most of the questions that I have for you, but we always like to end by asking if there's anything that we didn't ask about that you wanted to share, or anything that you wanted to expand upon.
No, like I said, nowadays, for us long-time survivors, I mean, look, we've gone 22, 23 years with this illness. We have our good days and bad days, but mostly good days. Lately, with the medications, it's been more good days and bad days. And just be sure that you're educating yourself, and if somebody offers you an article or has something new that's out there, a new treatment, new diet regime, or a new way of educating yourself about anything like HIV and AIDS, make sure you have an open ear. Be receptive to what they're saying, because in a lot of ways it can help you quite a bit with this wholeness. Okay.
Yeah. Anything else?
Try to make good choices. That's about it. Because it can definitely alter your life.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for sharing with us. And thanks. I'm going to just stop this now.
Okay.